ashwagandha.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
oh, yeah.
We're gonna have a solartopia.
Started to burn too many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with the legendary Pete Seeger and, of course, David Burns, who wrote the song along with me. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you for another hour at the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Great to be on PRN, and I got a couple of great guests with us today. We're going to fill the hour with Professor Peter Matthews. Peter, are you with us?
I'm sure here, Sluggo. How you doing, Harvey?
I'm good. I'm great. How are you? And you're in sunny Southern California. And then we got the fantastic, the legendary Charlie Komaroff. Charlie, are you with us?
Hey, Harvey. What's going on?
I am great. And, of course, you and I together had dinner last night in dark, cold New York City. I am talking to you from scenic Teaneck, New Jersey, at the home of my daughter and son-in-law and my grandson, Eliav. We're going to have a great show here. We got a ton to talk about. We're going to start talking about the Trump exit and the government shutdown with this lunatic in the White House. Just no end to this guy, although I think there is an end. I am predicting, ladies and gentlemen, that Donald Trump will be out of the White House by Earth Day, April 22nd. Nature bats last, and I think he's about to strike out. That's my prediction. Charlie will chime in on that as well. And then we're going to go and talk about the Green New Deal and the energy transition. Nobody knows more about that than the great Charlie Komaroff. So we got a really great hour to look forward to here. I, of course, skipped. My stomach, I have to watch my constitution. I can't stand watching Donald Trump too much. I think it's bad for my health. And listeners, I'm going to recommend as a doctor that everybody avoid looking at this guy. I think he is a source of deep disease. Every time I see him, I feel queasy and just want to puke. So I'm recommending that if we know he's on TV, I can't stand to look at his picture in the newspaper or online. And so every time I don't see him, I feel better. So I did not watch his national address about the wall that he wants to build, which is utterly insane. It's a complete diversion, has absolutely no meaning except that keeps him in the spotlight, keeps his bigotry going and just gives him an excuse to do whatever he wants to do. I am predicting that sooner rather than later, we're going to start to see his family, hopefully in orange jumpsuits, being perp walked into various jails, most likely in New York. But we'll get to that because Charlie, of course, especially is in New York. But Peter Matthews, you're a frequent guest on CNN, professor
yes.
of political science, teacher at two colleges in Southern California. Tell us what you think. Where is this going with Donald Trump? Am I completely off base predicting his departure in April? What's your take on all this? And then Charlie will jump in.
I don't know about April. Maybe April Fool's Day. No, I don't know about April, Harvey, but it could be sometime this year. It's going from bad to worse. He's just being so extreme about things. Now, threatening a national emergency, Harvey, that's the latest. As he marches to the border, he's threatening to declare a national emergency, which is based on the National Emergency Act, regulates the president from getting out of hand. But on the other hand, there are many, many laws on the books that are national emergency related, and they allow the president, if he declares it the way the law requires, he can actually seize private property, he can seize commodities, and he can declare martial law. This is very serious stuff. And he's verging on the verge of doing something like this because he's so adamant that he wants that wall or his voters won't vote for him again. That's what he thinks, I guess. It's ridiculous. And the wall's not going to work anyway. We know the reason that some folks come across the border here is because for jobs. They've been devastated by NAFTA and by the structural adjustments of the World Bank and the IMF. And they forced low-wage jobs in Mexico, and the American corporations take their jobs there and don't pay them enough. And we dump corn over there from our corporate-subsidized farmers here to drive the Mexican farmer out of business. He's a corn farmer. And he goes to a factory to find work, and they pay $4 an hour in the GM factory, and he can't make a living there. So some of them risk it and try to bring their families across the border here. Trump is not addressing any of that stuff, and that has to be done. It's completely red herring the wall to divert us.
Well, Charlie, I want to get your two cents was hidden here, and then we'll jump back to Peter.
I'm with everything that the two of you have been saying. You know, what we're all waiting for is for one and then two and then many sitting Republican members of the House and especially the Senate to show some conscience and spine and rise up and speak out against Trump's madness, especially this latest madness. And, you know, we can understand, I guess, knowing, you know, politics, that sitting Republicans aren't going to be speaking out against white supremacy and against patriarchy and against misogyny, you know, whether it's Trumpian or their own. But this shutdown, you know, maybe, just maybe, this will be the spark that will lead, again, a few of them and then more and more to have the courage to speak out. And then the wall that has been Republican support for Trump, which is all that really keeps him propped up and in power, maybe that wall will begin to crumble.
Well, my understanding is, and I just saw this, and I think I got it right, that 22 Republicans in the Senate are up for re-election in 2020. And so 22, you got to get to 67 to remove, right? You have to have two-thirds of the Senate to remove a sitting
president. Yeah, 67.
Mm-hmm. I think you only need a majority of the House to impeach. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's correct, Harvey.
So that could happen tomorrow. Basically,
absolutely.
Well, the Democrats have what, a 30-seat majority in the Senate, in the House now?
They're at 39 seats, almost 40-seat majority.
Okay, now I want to take a little deep. Wow, and then also a one seat is still up for grabs, the one in North Carolina, where the guy blatantly stole the thing. So not that there weren't other blatant thefts. I want to throw one thing in here, because we do have an hour, and I want to cover this. The Democrats have a 39-seat majority in the House. It should be about 50 because of gerrymandering. You know, I spent much of my life in Ohio, and Ohio has 16 congressional seats. And in this past election, the Democrat-Republican vote was about 50-50. But because of gerrymandering, the congressional delegation is 12 to 4. I mean, come on. You know.
A little lopsided. Yeah.
Right. So realistically, if it was 8 to 8, that means that the Democrats should legitimately have 4 or 5 more seats in the Congress. The similar situation in North Carolina. I believe there are 14 congressional seats from North Carolina, and I believe it's divided 11-3. I should know that, but I'm going to put that pretty much at. So if it was instead of 11-3, it should be 7-7. So take the 4 from Ohio and the 4 from North Carolina. Legitimately, just from those two states being gerrymandered, the Democrats should have 8 more congressional seats. In the House of Representatives. And now a couple of states, Maryland is pretty badly gerrymandered for the Democrats. But there are a couple, I'm sure Wisconsin is in a similar situation also. So legitimately the Democrats really should have at least 10 more seats in the Congress. Can you imagine a 50-seat majority
in the House of Representatives. I mean, that would be really spectacular. And 40's good, although, you know, the Democrats themselves aren't all that great in general anyway. But nonetheless, I wanted to make sure I threw that in there. And I believe that there will be a major gerrymandering case coming before the Supreme Court soon. And you know, now with Brett Kavanaugh up there, we don't know which way it's going to go. I also want to point out, by the way, and I know many people are concerned about gerrymandering, which we should. It's at the core, part of the core of why our government is so catastrophically messed up. And by the way, I avoided the F word there because on this show we can use four-letter words technically, but we like to rebroadcast, and there are a number of networks that rebroadcast the show, and we have to avoid four-letter words from them. So you two guys are pretty civil, but I have had...
hey, Harvey, could I add one more thing to that, if you don't mind, about the gerrymandering?
Oh, absolutely, of course.
Yeah. Well, I can do that after you finish, if you want.
No, go ahead.
Okay, yeah, I was going to mention, that in the similar vein, the U.S. Senate is very unrepresentative of the numbers, Harvey, as you know. About 20% of the population actually elects over half the U.S. senators in the U.S. Senate. And that's because of how we set this thing up originally, with, you know, try to represent the small states and let the large states not overrun them, et cetera, in the Senate. But still, you got to point that out. It's very unfair representation. And it gives the conservative, mostly right-wing, rural-oriented small-town states a big advantage in Supreme Court confirmations. It gives them a big advantage in the Electoral College. So many things. But that's your noted also.
Yeah, and they ratify treaties. And, you know, I am a Californian. I'm registered to vote in California now. And my state has 40 million people and two senators. And the 20 smallest states in the United States also have 40 million people, and they have 40 senators. And, of course, a lot of those states are very conservative. So, yeah, well, the Senate's a mess. You're right. The Senate is the embodiment, the poster child for gerrymandering in this country. And, again, it will decide, you know, decides on budgets Well, the House initiates the budget, but the Senate still passes. The Senate passes on treaties, and the Senate makes the judicial appointments. And, you know, so you're right. And it's really a major drag on the idea that we're a democracy. I mean, again, California, which is a tenth of the country, more than a tenth of the country, has only two senators. And one of them is Dianne Feinstein, for God's sake, which is outrageous, you know. I mean,
there are no other democracies that I know, Western industrial democracy, or even Japan, that has this misrepresentation, disproportionate representation for a few people in that kind of body.
Yeah, it's outrageous.
Structure.
It's outrageous, and it's got to change. I mean, we have a lot of, look, you know, you can say what you will about the American Constitution. For its time, it was of course, the Declaration is what we love, but for its time, the American Constitution was a pretty radical document.
No landed
aristocracy, no inherited presidency, the presidency came out a lot stronger than a lot of people wanted to do. You know, back then these guys assumed that people were going to be civil. I mean, you know, there's a lot of economic injustice in the American Constitution, the Constitution was drawn up by rich white guys. There was no indigenous, no women. No blacks, no farmers. You know, it was a very, very elite group, and it was done in secret. And there was no transcript. There's no transcript of the Constitutional Convention. But nonetheless, they did a reasonable job because these men, Madison, Jefferson, Washington, Franklin, whatever flaws we have unveiled in them over the years, they did believe in civic responsibility. And they did want to make as a reasonable a constitution as they could. And, you know, all things considered, you know, they did a reasonable job. Not great, but
right.
Well, I guess you can even say it was great. But it was certainly lacking. But now the flaws in it...
Unfortunately, the amendment to the Constitution provision, which I'm sure the two of you are far more fluent in than am I, you know, that's the cross we have to bear, and it's really crushing us. And, you know, you guys know the math better than I do, that, you know, a tiny percentage, even less than that 20%, I think it's probably 14% of the American population, it can frustrate any amendment to the Constitution simply because, as you know, it requires two-thirds majorities in each House of Congress, and then three-fourths of the state legislatures have to ratify as well. And so nobody, and Peter, maybe you're more in touch with current research on this than I am, or Harvey, you too, can see a way out of the trap that we're in, where we're going to be stuck with two senators per state indefinitely. Is there a way out?
Peter,
well, I must say that if you really want some real change, there is one congressman, a member of the House, I think, who, I'm not saying this should be done, but he's advocating an amendment that would actually abolish the Senate, believe it or not. But I'm not advocating that. I'm just saying, other than that, I don't know what way out there is about the disproportionate representation, which has a lot to do with slavery and also with the ultimate gerrymandering, as you said, Harvey, the states that are large and small getting equal numbers in the Senate. There's just no way around that.
My understanding is that the population disparities that we now have between, say, California and Wyoming, which is, about 50 or 60 to 1, those disparities were much smaller back in 1787.
That's right.
They were.
Good point. Very true.
Right. They were. And, if you'd have laid out the current reality to the members of the Constitutional Convention, I think things would have been very different. But not all that much different. I mean, they did believe in the rule of the rich, by and large, that you didn't have any serious, hardcore, grassroots, small-D Democrats in the Constitutional Convention. Tom Paine was not a member of the Constitutional Convention. Wouldn't have been allowed in if he just showed up at the door. But I don't think Hamilton might have liked it, but bad, I don't think they didn't foresee and they didn't like. And they wouldn't have liked. And I have to say, though, in deference to our nation and our founding founders, I didn't want to say fathers there, but they were all men, of course.
Right.
We do have the greatest single document ever written, as far as I'm concerned, as part of our government, and that is the Bill of Rights. And there's no greater or more important paragraph than has ever been written than the First Amendment to the Constitution of the United States, which I will now recite for you. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of grievances. Now, when I was teaching college history, which I hope to again, on the midterm exam, any student who could reproduce that by heart, and I gave them the option to stand up and sing it, basically, got an extra 10 points.
Did you get?
Oh, a lot. I got a lot.
Really?
More than half
wow.
In writing. And then I started later, as I taught more, I got more and more students who got up and recited it. There's an advantage when you're reciting it, you don't have to worry about spelling or punctuation. So it's easy to do it. So
but it is a great, really great amendment. I mean, that's the key to the American system of freedom of expression and thought, so we can actually change the society without being suppressed when we advocate positive change. And freedom of conscience,
yes.
All of that's very important, it's freedom of speech. And
Well, and the reason I say it's the most important paragraph ever written, it's okay, you got all men are created equal, and you got the Universal Declaration of Bill of Rights, and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the rights of man, and all this other stuff. The reason the First Amendment I consider to be the most important document is because it's the law. It actually has impact on our daily lives. And, whole libraries are filled with books about the first phrase of the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. What does that mean? I mean, it's the separation clause. The practice thereof. So, it's sheer genius, the First Amendment. It is the greatest thing that has ever been done in this country. And Madison actually resisted writing it. When they discussed the Bill of Rights in the Constitutional Convention, and they say, oh, well, we don't really need it. But when they rolled out the Constitution, the public was really angry. They didn't want a strong central government, and they definitely wanted a Bill of Rights. And it became clear that if they didn't do a Bill of Rights, the founders, that there would be another revolution, and that the country would not accept the Constitution. And so they
And I believe that Jefferson was a big driving force in terms of insisting on the Bill of Rights being actually written down as opposed to just assumed.
Jefferson and Madison were neighbors, and they were like Mutt and Jeff. Jefferson was like 6'1". Madison was literally 5'4". He remains the shortest president in our history. Huh. And they were such good friends that Jefferson had a room at Monticello just for Madison, because they were close by and they visited all the time. But Jefferson was actually not in the Constitution Convention.
No, he was in France. He was in France representing the United States. But his idea was that there needs to be a written document, that First Amendment, or what, the First Ten Amendments, in writing rather than just an assumption that it will be followed by the government, because of the political culture. Well, he wanted it in writing on purpose. But, maybe you're the historian, Ari, so maybe you have more.
No, he came back. He came back before the Bill of Rights was amended. The Bill of Rights was adopted on December 15, 1791, 2 years after the Constitution was adopted, because it was very clear that if they didn't do the Bill of Rights, they were going to get overthrown. And Jefferson
December 15, 1791?
Yes.
Wow, that's right around the day that Mozart died.
Exactly. Wow. You're right. You're exactly right about that. And you're probably the only guest that I will ever have on the show who knew that.
Sorry, it was December 5th. How could I be such a fool?
Oh, yeah. Well, and you also remember that Beethoven's birthday was December 16th, but not 17th.
Wow, lots of December events here.
Well, my birthday is December 31st, and you guys have celebrated my birthday every year on New Year's Eve, but we won't get into that, although I will expect a present next year.
That's right.
So at any rate, Jefferson was in France at the time of the Constitution Convention. He was busy impregnating Sally Hemings, and I will be talking about that. I'll let my listeners know that I had an op-ed published in Los Angeles Times. I co-wrote it with Avelia Jones, who is a descendant of Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings. And this is the first piece in a major American publication to advocate that Sally Hemings, Tom Jefferson's African-American servant, be acknowledged as the third First Lady of the United States. Part of the research... We looked this up, and the White House lists our first ladies. And they list for Tom Jefferson's first lady, his first wife, Martha Wales Skelton Jefferson. They had six children, and all but two of them died before adulthood. But she died in 1782. They had been married in 1771, I think. But she died 20 years before Tom Jefferson became president. And they still list her as his first lady. The White House didn't even exist. The United States didn't exist when she died. And so Jefferson, before he got in the White House, had already fathered one child with Sally Hemings, who's now become quite well known. And Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings had three children while Tom was president. No other president had more than one while he was president. Jack Kennedy had one, and I think one other president had one child while president. But Sally and Tom had three. And I'm going to guarantee you on this show now, I'm going to be the first to guarantee you that within the next 10 years, the White House will have to officially recognize Sally Hemings as his first lady. And all the
visuals. That's fantastic.
Yeah, it is.
That would be.
Because all the visuals now are going to show the president, and then they're going to show this African-American woman as our third first lady. And Tom, and next week, by the way, I will have Avelia on the show. She was scheduled this week, but couldn't make it. So we're going to do it next week. But I will guarantee you that she will be very widely recognized as our third first lady. She hooked up with Tom Jefferson around 1790, in the 1790s, and he died in 1826. They were together almost 40 years. And, wow. You know, this is a serious relationship. There's no indication that he was with anyone other than Sally Hemings once they started together. They started together in Paris. He brought her over as the nanny for his younger daughter. She was a teenager, and he was pushing, he was in his 40s. There was a 30-year age gap between him and Sally Hemings. And they were having children into the early 1800s. So there you go. That's I love the Sally Hemings story. It's just an amazing story, and we'll tell the whole story next week with Avelia Jones on the show. But I did want to mention, anybody who's interested, you can go online and read the story in the LA Times, and I will post it. So anyway,
I'm looking at it right now. It's fantastic.
Yeah, it's an amazing. Well, Avelia is a good friend of mine. And we recently did a reenactment of Dr. King's legacy, and we had it was organized by the great Ed Rampell, who's a writer based in L.A. And we had Sally portrayed by Avelia, and she came up, and she's like the great 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 granddaughter of Tom and Sally, and she dressed up in a period costume. And recited, you know, something that we would have imagined Sally had said. We have nothing written from her, but it was fantastic. This is a big deal. Mm-hmm. This is a real big part of American history. So, folks, if you're interested, you can go to the LA Times website or email me, and I will send you a copy of the piece.
Yeah, or just Google Sally Hemings, Los Angeles Times, Harvey Wasserman, and, you know, Avelia Jones. Understandably, is credited as the author, but then at the bottom, there's a mention of Harvey's role in writing and publishing this piece.
Yes, and Sally, of course, is a resident of Los Angeles, and there is a very substantial population in Los Angeles of people who are descended from Tom and Sally, because his grandson or great grandson moved to L.A. and became the first elected African-American official on the West Coast, not just in California. Frederick Madison Roberts was his name, or Hemings Roberts, I think. And he was a member of the California Assembly for 18 years and became a great personal friend of Earl Warren, who became the chief justice. He was governor of California, became the chief justice of the Supreme Court.
Right.
And I would imagine that his friendship with the descendant of Tom and Sally may have been an influence on the Board of Education.
On the Warren Court. So wow. But this is like a whole new strand in American history. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah. Well, that's why I love history so much, you know. Who can make this stuff up? Who would ever dream that a descendant of Tom Jefferson and Sally Hemings would wind up in Los Angeles and be in the Assembly and become the friend of the governor, who then became the Chief Justice, and then wrote the decision ending segregation.
Brown v. Board, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, what a connection. Isn't it an amazing connection? You know, I'll bet if we could dig up Earl Warren and ask him if his friendship with Frederick Roberts, the descendant of Tom and Sally, influenced his decision on Brown versus Board of Education, I bet he'd say yes. You know, I mean, how could he not?
I would say something.
Anyway, let's get back to the Trump exit here. And since we're talking about exits, I'm sure you both know that there's now a vastly important reconsideration of the Brexit, of the idea that Britain will leave the European Union. And the polls are now showing that the majority of the British population no longer wants to leave the European Union. I'm going to tell you right now that I will bet you any amount of money, well, you know, whatever, that Britain's not going to leave the European Union. I bet they do not leave it. She, Theresa May, the current prime minister, is not going to be able to cut a deal that is going to work for them to leave the European Union. So the question now is the Trump exit. How will Trump leave? I am virtually certain he will not serve out this first term. And I'm going to tell you why. He has completely alienated three of the most powerful constituencies on this planet, which is the corporate elite. I mean, the corporations, I guarantee you, all the boardrooms, they're tearing their hair out over this moron in the White House. Whatever Donald Trump was going to deliver to the super rich, he has delivered. He's given them the tax cut. You know, he's destroyed environmental regulation. I'm sure there are a few other favors they've wanted. But they know the super rich in this country, they want stability. And this is the embodiment of total chaos. It's the last thing they want. And then he's angered the American military, for God's sakes, with the one thing he's done that I've supported, which talk about pulling out of Syria. He's not going to do it. I mean, I guarantee you he's not going to do it. And Afghanistan, I wish he would, but he won't. And the intelligence agencies, you know, who he insulted left and right. The last president of the United States to really anger the intelligence agencies was who, guys?
John F. Kennedy.
Yeah.
You got it. And we know what happened to him. So, Peter Matthews, you're the political science professor. Take my thesis that Trump is going to leave and tell us how it happened.
Well, I really do believe what you just said, Harvey, is correct, that he has alienated all these three extremely important constituencies. The economy is going into shambles, not to mention Wall Street, with the elite love. They want certainty, and the reason that the market's been up and down is because he's got an uncertain leader, so-called leader at the top. So he, I'm not sure it'll be exactly how he will be exiting, but he may just actually resign if he sees the writing on the wall that some senators, about 20 senators, switch over and decide to go in and vote for conviction once he is impeached by the House. He might actually resign as Nixon did. But Nixon actually resigned before the impeachment was actually ordered upon, except in the committee. He might resign after that, after the House impeaches him, and then before the Senate convicts him. Because he just loves power, and he doesn't even know what it is. He doesn't even know how to run this country at all, anyway. He has no clue. He's way out of his league. And I don't think he's even able to be manipulated by the corporate elite. That's why they don't like him at this point, to some extent. He gave them their tax cuts, like you said. Huge tax cuts. And 80% went to the top 1%, and more than that, actually. And the working to middle class got virtually nothing, working poor, zero. And that stuff is old, you know, Reaganomics on steroids. But it's even worse now because the elite doesn't trust what his judgment. And not to mention foreign policy with North Korea, where he almost had us in a nuclear exchange, very possibly, the way he was rattling off. Doesn't even understand the agreed framework or how he could negotiate to, and why North Korea is so concerned about its own being invaded by the U.S. He didn't know anything. I bet he didn't even know that North Korea had never signed a treaty. We never signed a treaty in the Korean War. He probably didn't even know that. So this man's way out of his league, and I think he's going to be gone this year itself, Harvey. But the question is, will he resign before he's removed by the Senate or even before he's impeached by the House? I think that he may wait till the impeachment is actually in place. And then decide to, looking at how the Senate might react, he might then decide whether to stay or to resign. And don't forget that this whole idea about whether the sitting president can be indicted. There's so much evidence, it seems like either circumstantial evidence or some type of indication that he has been really involved, you know, in the violation of the Emoluments Clause by making lots of money off of foreign governments in his hotels and other places. He's violated so many different rules and laws that it looks to me that, you know, he might actually be indicted and convicted once he's out of office. Because if he can't be indicted in office, which he might still be able to be indicted, that's an open question, he could easily be indicted when he's out of office and then possibly.
Oh, I think that's a definite. I don't think there's any doubt that he will be indicted once he leaves the White House. And I think that's actually an incentive that will keep him in the White House. Frankly, and a lot of people have said that.
Except if a deal is cut. But can I ask you, like, you guys?
Sure, yeah.
You know, what do you think Congress, you know, and the Democratic majority in the House especially, and the insurgents in on the Democratic side, what should they and what should we be telling them to be doing right now? Should they be, and should we be focusing on impeaching? should they and we be focusing on bread and butter issues, you know, redistribution of income and wealth, minimum wage, taxation?
I think we should be doing, they should be doing both, actually. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, and being in office requires that ability. And I think the Democrats like Pelosi should stop saying impeachment's off the table, we got to wait for Mueller. By the way, the Constitution requires the U.S. House to be the ultimate grand jury. It's not a special counsel that decides that as to whether someone's guilty or not. So to push it off on Mueller and say we're going to wait on Mueller, that's a dereliction of duty to some extent by the House itself, which is the ultimate grand jury, which should be actually investigating him with charges of impeachment if there's evidence for that. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that it's circumstantial that this should be investigated, and the House should not be reluctant to actually impeach. We should be letting our progressive members, like Ocasio-Cortez and others, know, and besides other people, the moderate, so-called moderate corporate Democrats, know that if this man has violated the public trust, because don't forget, impeachment is not just a regular crime like a robbing a bank or breaking a traffic law. Impeachment has to do with high crimes or misdemeanors, which has to do with a violation of the public trust in the case of obstruction of justice or dereliction of duty. There's all kinds of non-criminal, non-normal criminal charges that high crimes can fit the definition for. And that's how they should be looking at it. The House should be looking at it in a larger context. And removing this man, who is very dangerous for this country and has already proven to be so in so many ways. So I think we should be doing both. Both. Focusing on the economic bread and butter issues, the single-payer health care system. We should be focusing on the Green New Deal. Green New Deal is extremely important. All that, and also look at impeachment. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, so let's jump in on this. Charlie, you've raised the issue, and I want to talk to you about the Green New Deal. I want to end this by saying, this particular part of the discussion, by saying I am 100% convinced that members of the Trump family will be indicted within a short period of time by the state of New York, and that is really going to change everything. I also want to point out that it's in the news today that the Democrats...
Is it the state of New York, or is it the Southern District?
Southern District. That's the state of New York. Or the state of New York, the Attorney General, right?
The federal government.
The attorney, it's more important... The state indictments are going to be more important than the federal, because Trump can pardon his family on the federal charges, even if
they
come
federal,
from the
state.
Southern District.
He cannot.
So I think what he'll do is he'll probably build a wall around New York City. Anyway, we'll get to that in a minute. So I want to point that out. But Charlie, I want to point out very quickly that today the Democrats announced that they are going to have public testimony from Michael Cohen. That is going to be spectacular.
Yes.
And, you know, that will be really amazing. And that's going to, anyway, we'll wait for that. We're actually rolling along here. And I want to turn to Charlie Komenoff to get to the next big part of this. And you've raised it, and Peter will have much to say about the Green New Deal. So there's all this talk now about a Green New Deal. I haven't seen one on paper. And Charlie, you are one of the world's leading experts on energy. And, of course, the energy is going to be at the heart of the Green New Deal. So tell us what you see coming.
Harvey, you're putting me on the spot and sort of showing the my lack of homework, because, as you know and as we've discussed, but your listeners don't know, I've been off in other ventures, including and especially something involving New York City called congestion pricing, which, you know, unfortunately, we won't have time to get into. It's a way to thin out traffic and raise money to revitalize public transportation in New York City, and, you know, turn on my switch and I can talk about it for hours, but not at this time. A little bit ironically, it seems to have been Tom Friedman, the New York Times columnist, who a dozen or so years ago coined the phrase Green New Deal to describe a mobilization of public investment, government investment, and a lot of private investment that would rapidly move the United States even more rapidly than solar and wind and energy efficiency, which have been going off like wildfires, so to speak, in the last few years especially, to bend the curves even further upward so that we can reverse the unfortunate trend of 2018, in which U.S. carbon emissions appear to have gone up by 3 or 3.5%, you know, reversing a decade of some good progress, but, you know, not nearly fast enough, and get the U.S. substantially off fossil fuels, you know, within the next decade or two, and fleshing out what this public and private investment is going to consist of, fleshing out whether a carbon tax can and should be part of this package. That's going to be interesting from an intellectual standpoint, an analytical standpoint, and a public organizing and moving standpoint, especially over the next year, because the determination of just about everybody in the progressive wing of the Democratic Party and everybody to the left of that is that whoever runs as a Democrat for president in 2020 is going to have to and want to run for president on a Green New Deal platform, on a climate hawk platform, and not be not say climate and we're going to stop climate change and get off the fossil fuels with a nod and a wink and apologetically, but make it the bulwark of her platform and make it clear that 2020 is going to be a referendum on a great many things, a single-payer health system, as Peter pointed out, a national minimum wage, as we all want, environmental and health and worker safety standards, on and you know, and a non-militaristic foreign policy. But equal among them, and maybe even more than equal among them, is going to be something like a Green New Deal, which we don't know yet what its components are going to be, but it's going to have to be centered on green jobs distributed throughout all 3,000 counties in the United States so that all states and counties can share in the jobs, the employment, and the investment and get the U.S. substantially off fossil fuels within a decade and pretty much entirely off fossil fuels by 2040.
Very well stated. I want to ask you two things, Troy, and we're cheating here because we had dinner last night, and two things came up that I'd really like to you to talk to. First of all, you said that had something to the effect about had the country adopted California's energy policies a while ago. Do you remember what you said about that?
Yeah, well, let's see. I'm popping open the lid on something that's supposed to be you know, embargoed until late February when this study gets out the door.
Right.
But, you know, yeah. But basically, you know, California over the past 40 years, beginning even, if you can believe this, at the end of the Reagan administration, you know, in the same way that Richard Nixon, because he happened to have been president in 1970 during Earth Day and when the Clean Air Act was passed and the National Environmental Policy Act and all that amazing, powerful ferment that led up to and was put into orbit by Earth Day, you know, people say, oh, Nixon was an environmental president. And practically nothing could be further from the truth. He saw the handwriting on the wall. He had to go along with this environmental fervor. A good number of Republicans back then, this is 1970, not 2019, understood the need to protect and preserve the environment and cut down on air and water pollution. So he signed all that legislation. Well, in the same way, in 1974, in his last year out of his 8 years in office, Governor Ronald Reagan signed legislation that established the California Energy Commission, that put in motion energy efficiency standards for appliances and buildings, and that would ultimately, when Jerry Brown was governor in his first two terms from 75 through 82, would set in motion the first stirrings of solar and wind power and industries in California. And it was, you know, I almost hate to say the word bipartisan because to me it's become kind of a cruel joke at this point when you look at the national political scene. But California pretty consistently over these past 45 years has had a bipartisan state policy that has fostered and enabled the percolation of energy efficiency through pretty much every vein and artery of the state's economy, so much so that if the other 49 states had made as much progress as California has during that time in getting off of fossil fuels, the United States today would be emitting 25% less carbon dioxide, which would be a big effing deal.
Yeah, it would be. And then you are, and thank you for that exposition. I'm sure Peter and I, as Californians, are both puffing up our chests at what you just said. The other thing that you are a major advocate of the carbon tax, and I'm sure that the carbon tax is going to be a very big part of the discussion of the Green New Deal. So can you explain that to us, and then we'll go to Peter to jump in with more.
Well, at this point, Harvey, probably everybody, you know, listening to your shows knows the outline of what a carbon tax is. It's, you know, let's be straight up. It's a tax on fossil fuels, on so-called natural gas or methane, oil, and especially coal, according to their carbon content. It's a means to internalize the climate damage that burning of fossil fuels inevitably causes, because there's no feasible way to burn coal in a power plant or oil or gasoline in your car or natural gas in a home furnace or in an industrial plant that does not emit 100% of the carbon dioxide that's generated by combusting these carbon-based fuels into oxygen. And that's basically what generates the heat that makes fossil fuels able to do the work that we want them to do. But there is this byproduct of carbon dioxide, which is the major greenhouse gas that is heating up and, you know, burning up our atmosphere and our oceans, and is causing, and it's going to accelerate like gangbusters, climate disasters, weather disasters, changes in agriculture. You know, hey, we know all that. And a carbon tax can do two good things. It disincentivizes the burning of fossil fuels by making them more expensive in the marketplace. I know a dirty word to some people, but that's what our economy is pretty much based on. And it also provides revenue that could be invested in this so-called just transition to accelerate and amplify the market force that is implicit in making fossil fuels more expensive. But for various reasons, which we may not have time to get into, carbon taxing has proven to be very divisive. It's not just that Republicans despise it, because they know how effective it is in keeping fossil fuels in the ground, at cutting into the profitability of coal and oil and natural gas. It is a dagger directly at the heart of extractionism and republicanism and corporate big energy and fossil fuels. But unfortunately, carbon taxing has even become, or has also become, somewhat divisive within the left. And I'm really hoping that 2019 is going to be the year in which a lot of misconceptions that a lot of my friends and our friends on the left have surrounded themselves with regarding carbon taxing, because I feel that it is essential. It's not the only tool that we need in the toolbox, but it is fundamental to this rapid energy transition from coal, oil, and gas to solar, wind, and efficiency.
Beautiful. Right from the horse's mouth. Thank you so much, Tara. I know you've been present at the creation of the movement for a carbon tax, and I'm very happy and honored to have that exposition on our show. So Peter Matthews, as a political scientist, that was important for you to hear as well. I will say that as an anti-nuclear person, I'm hoping the carbon tax will be accompanied by a tax on thermal emissions, because thermal emissions also are, you know, critical in this whole equation. And
absolutely,
that would,
yes.
That would
go ahead.
Give us
I was going to second that. You're absolutely right about nuclear power needing to be taxed as well. But go ahead and finish up, Harvey, because I got a few things to say in response to.
Well, that was it. Charlie and I have discussed the carbon tax, and I am all for. I'm 100% for the carbon tax, but I would like to see it accompanied by a tax on thermal emissions and also, of course, on radioactive emissions, and that complicates the discussion. But I'm sure we can spend the next 2 hours talking about that.
Right.
Now, Peter Matthews.
Let me just, in response to the couple of things that were raised with that great expose of Charles, and that is the back in the Jerry Brown eras when he was ostensibly doing some things and moving the state of California toward more alternative way of looking at energy. The problem is that with Jerry Brown and other elected officials, some of the so-called progressives, is that these progressive politicians, is that they've accepted money from the oil and gas industry. They've accepted money from corporations as a whole, and specifically from oil and gas, and even maybe from coal as well. And here is that their hands are tied, and Jerry Brown actually basically courtesy to the oil industry by backing fracking. You know, we want him to come out strongly against fracking in the state. That's one reason we have like oil coming out of the ground, is because fracking was perfected in the last few years, which allowed a much more efficient way, from their point of view, of getting this carbon out of the ground and ruining our environment. Without fracking, we would not have extracted as much oil as we had gas, natural gas, that we have now. So I think there's a two-sided viewpoint in terms of some of the progressive politicians is they want to please their corporate donors, especially their carbon donors, and at the same time they want to appear to be environmental and give us a few things. And I'm not saying that he did not do anything good. Jerry Brown did help with a few things, and so did other politicians. But we are at a point now, as you both know, that not only the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, as well as the U.S. government, Trump's own scientists in the government that he supposedly heads, have come out with very critical assessments as to we only have the fact that we only have about 12 years left. And by the 2030, we have to cut these carbon emissions at least way back in half to where they were. We are in a situation that's so critical. That's where the Green New Deal has to be. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I want to put to you a proposition, and I'm going to be straight up and say that even though this report, you know, that I've sort of telegraphed a few minutes ago is not going to talk about this, it's quite frankly what motivated me to look at the numbers and got me on the path of doing the report. It is my position, and I want you to argue back if you feel that way, that California could have banned fracking. Jerry Brown could have signed executive orders preventing the lifting of any more oil and gas out of the ground in California at any point in time, and it would have made not a particle of difference in the amount of carbon dioxide emitted in California or in the world, which is driving us toward climate disaster. It would have been a good thing for the local environment to shut down all those oil and gas wells and stop new ones from being built, but my belief is that the same demand, because motorists were going to drive as much as they were going to drive and homes were going to be heated with oil, you know, on and on, would have been fulfilled by oil and natural gas lifted out of the ground somewhere else. Do you think that that's right or wrong?
No, I think there's partial truth there.
Are you asking Harvey or me?
Either one. Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, yeah.
I would defer.
I think that,
Charlie,
that
if,
the...
Well, wait, if Charlie thinks that's true, I think it's probably true.
Go ahead, Harvey.
Charlie, if you think that's true, it's probably true. But
Come on, because just because I say it, you know, seriously, and I'm not trying to be coy or argumentative, you know, either one. It's a position that I have. It's part of what makes me kind of like jaundiced about, you know, Bill McKibben, my pal and maybe yours, you know, with, you know, Keep It in the Ground. I mean, Keep It in the Ground is building an amazing movement, and it is essential to protect native lands and spiritual lands and the local environment. But I don't, in order to crush fossil fuels and the carbon crisis, we've got to crush demand for them. And that's what a Green New Deal, which I hope will include a carbon tax, is going
to
do.
That, Charles, the demand and supply, or supply and demand equation, is not the only thing to reduce carbon emissions. You said that it wouldn't have made a difference, but I tell you, we could have combined that with a breakneck program to bring in electric cars to actually subsidize them, like Norway has done. In Norway, half the cars in Norway, 52%, are electric now because the government stepped in and gave all kinds of incentives. Subsidies for people to buy the cars.
Oh, my God.
We're
done. Thank you so much, you guys. You guys are great. I have to have you back. Peter Matthews, thank you so much. What a great show.
Okay, stay there.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Don't you know we're going to have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia.
Bit that